Good morning, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to our conference call. It's a busy week of reporting this week, so we'll try and get to our questions quickly and answer as many of yours as we have quickly. It's an exciting quarter for us to report. With me this morning in the room, I've got Scott Robinson, our Chief Operating Officer, and Kathy Turgeon, our CFO, and of course, Jim Grant, our Investor Awareness Rep. Normally, we'd also have Dave Thomas, our VP of Exploration, JP Lachance, our VP of Exploitation, and Tim Louie, our VP of Land, but those guys are all getting some much-needed vacation days. As you can probably tell from our release, the second half of the year is going to be very busy, so we need those guys all well-rested. Jim, I see you've got a bunch of questions from shareholders, so why don't we kick it off with you?
Okay. For those of you who are new to our conference calls, we hold the first half as a question and answer session where I ask some of the senior management questions about Peyto and its latest financials before we turn the call over to questions from investors and representatives of investment businesses. Darren, our latest financial results are just out showing positive earnings and substantial cash flow. And this is despite the fact that natural gas prices hit their lowest level in over 10 years in the second quarter. How do you feel we stack up against some of the other gas-weighted companies in the second quarter?
Well, Jim, you know, there's no question that with us being the lowest cost producer, that's insulating us a lot during this time of low natural gas prices. You know, in fact, our cash netbacks really are almost the same as those other operators with close to half of their production in the form of oil or liquids. You know, I ran through a few numbers. Obviously, I'm looking at results as they're coming out too, and I noted that Trilogy, for example, they've got, I think, 40% oil. They had a $17 a barrel cash netback, the same as ours. ARC, I think they're about 60% gas, 40% oil. They had a $19 netback. Bonavista's 60% gas, 40% liquids. They had about a $16 netback. So, you know, I think we're doing really well. You look at some of the gassier names, Tourmaline, they were 87% gas. They had a $13 a barrel netback. Progress is 85% gas. They had a $7 a barrel netback. So, you know, in perspective, our 90% gas portfolio and a $17 netback is pretty impressive. And I think that makes a big difference when you're trying to fund your capital program from your cash flow.
It sure does. Turning to Scott Robinson, our COO and VP of Operations. Scott, our operating costs in this quarter reflect a further decrease from our industry-leading cost structure. The best of our competitors don't seem to be able to get these levels, and of course not to the levels of netbacks that we see even on companies with higher liquids yields. How do we achieve costs like this?
Jim, yeah, we've always had a concerted focus on costs. It's been one of the cornerstones of our business. And it's obviously vital, as Darren has indicated, to considering the ups and downs of commodity prices. In particular, this last quarter, it was extremely important. Our historical costs have come in the 32 to 40 cent per MCF level for the past year and a half, 2 years or so. And this past quarter, we were actually able to get it down to 29 cents, about a 10% improvement over the previous lows, which is a key reason why we were able to achieve that 75% operating margin during this time of low gas prices. The reason for this low operating cost performance is really threefold. We've been able to achieve more production per field operator, and we've seen a lower manpower cost by about 10-11% over the past few quarters. And we expect that we can keep that up. That's been accomplished through some steps we've taken working with automation and other work process related matters. We've also seen a 25% reduction in our compressor maintenance costs over the past few quarters. And that's attributable to our effective preventive maintenance program for our huge fleet of rotating equipment. And thirdly, we've also seen a reduction in methanol consumption by a little over 10% this quarter to the same quarter of last year. And that in part is because of the mild weather, and that one may or may not be maintainable over the future. But that 30 cent in MCF level is something that we're going to aspire to repeat.
Also, Scott, we stated in our release that we have seen a more than 20% increase in liquids yield since the start of the year. Can you give us an idea of where this comes from and what further increases we're likely to see this year? Also, how much impact has this had on our revenues?
Yeah, sure. Our corporate liquid to gas ratio rose from a level of about 18 barrels per million to a level of 22 barrels per million from the beginning of the year to the end of the second quarter. That equates to a 10% to a 12% corporate liquid content for our production. That increase over the first half of the year is twofold. Firstly, with the decline in gas prices during the first quarter, we realigned our well species to focus on drilling the more liquids-rich types of wells, the Cardiums and the Falher's, and we've seen some impact from that, definitely, with some good Cardium results. Secondly, we've undertaken some plant modifications, some simple ones, to achieve colder processing temperatures and higher resultant liquid recoveries. The estimated monetary impact of what we've accomplished thus far is about $7 million on an annualized basis. It's just a first step, and that $7 million represents the increased value of selling those molecules as liquids as opposed to the gaseous form. You asked about what lies ahead. Well, we will continue to focus on the liquids-rich content of our development opportunities. And additionally, and very significantly, we're going to be starting up our Old Man Deep Cut facility in the fall. With that event, we expect to take our liquid to gas ratio up from a range of about 25 to 27 barrels per million corporately, or 13 to 14% liquids by the end of the year. And the approximate annualized incremental revenue benefit from those actions is on the order of about $20 million annualized.
Okay. So despite the six-week breakup period with little drilling and completion, we managed to drill a number of wells and saw our costs to drill drop year over year. How productive was our second quarter and how efficient?
Yeah. We did take a break during breakup this year as compared to last year. We did have some activity running through breakup. As a consequence, for the first half of the year, we've drilled 30 wells, with 10 of those, a third of them, coming in the second quarter. So it was a reasonably productive second quarter. We have continued to experience drilling time and the corresponding drilling cost reductions for our various well species over the last couple of years and through these last couple of quarters. The magnitude of these improvements have been about a 25% reduction for both our Cardium wells and our Manville wells in drill times, and about a 20% cost reduction for the Cardiums and about a 10% reduction in cost for the Manville wells over the last year and a half. And in absolute terms, we're drilling the Cardium wells for about $2 million a well right now, and our Manville wells for about $2.6 million a well, which are coming in, we believe, based on the benchmarking that we've done, at the lowest end of any of our competitors, so we're very proud of that that achievement. Looking forward, we've got 50 more wells to drill with our current six rigs, taking them up to eight rigs in the next month. And we look forward to maintaining or perhaps further improving on this drill cost improvement outcome.
Okay. So what progress have we made on our infrastructure plans in the second quarter? What's the outlook for the enhancement to liquids extraction, our deeper cut facilities being worked on right now?
I mentioned that we've made some plant improvement modifications thus far. And if we want to talk technical, we've taken our processes down from about -30 to -35 degrees before those modifications to about -40 to -45 Celsius after modification. The deep cut plant that we're currently installing, equipment is arriving and it's being installed out at our Old Man plant, will be a tail process to our Old Man plant or part of our Old Man plant. That's going to take things much colder to -80 degrees Celsius and have a marked improvement on liquid recoveries for 80 million cubic feet or 65% of our current corporate gas production. And that'll bump our liquid to gas ratios up from about 21 to about 34, 35 barrels per million for that segment of our production. So we're looking forward to that, and that's going to happen in the fall. I'll just kind of add to that, so, as some people may be aware, there's been a decrease in NGL prices over the last year, and particularly the last few months, in part because of surpluses. We're currently seeing, and it's been most significant for propane, we're currently seeing propane in the mid-teens, $13, $14, $15 per barrel. That compares to double that last year. The price has recovered somewhat recently, and the future strip looks good, showing recovery into the mid to high $20 per barrel range. Even at the lowest of that range, propane has a premium to be recovered in the liquid form of about 2 to 3 times the value of gaseous form. So we are still expecting, under the range of liquid pricing possibilities, we're still expecting very good economics for these plant projects that we're pursuing.
Darren, we have an ambitious plan to spend upwards of $300 million in capital in the second half of 2012. We've never spent this aggressively in the past. And if we were able to spend at this rate next year, even if you factor in an average breakup season, that would suggest that we could handle a capital program of $500 to $550 million. Do you see this as possible? How long would our inventory of drilling locations last at this rate?
Well, Jim, I guess, of course, we see it as possible, or we wouldn't be attempting it. But, you know, it's one of the great things about the horizontal multi-stage frac technology. Everybody's heard, you know, about the multiples that a horizontal well gives you 3 times a vertical well when it comes to production, or 3 times a vertical well when it comes to reserves recovered. And of course, the horizontal wells cost 3 times as much as a vertical well. But what's interesting, I think, is that the inverse is almost true with respect to the people. You know, for the same amount of people, we might be able to invest 3 times as much drilling horizontal wells as vertical wells. Because even though they cost 3 times as much, it really doesn't take 3 times as many people. Each location, in many ways, is still only one well. One more well for the production accountant to keep track of, one more well for a surface land administrator to go get surface on. You know, and there isn't even really 3 times as many invoices. The invoices are just 3 times as much. So, you know, it's that kind of multiplier that I think works in the reverse when it comes to the number of people that you need. It's not quite true when you get to drilling and completions. Obviously, those are those technical aspects are more complicated with horizontal wells. But generally speaking, I think we can get more and do more with less. And so that's why we think that we can accomplish such a big capital program, even though, you know, our team really hasn't grown by that much. We're still a little over 35 people here in the office. So, you know, a $550 million capital program, it's big, but it, you know, at the cost of an average horizontal well, it still only represents about 100 wells all in. And we've definitely drilled 100 wells per year before. It's just they were all vertical wells, not horizontal wells. So, you know, and 100 wells, based on our current inventory of locations that we're carrying, that's close to 1,000, you know, that's really only 1 out of 10 years of drilling inventory. So, you know, can we keep this rate up? I think we can keep it up for at least 10 more years, and who knows how many locations we're going to come up with over the next 10 years.
Mm-hmm. So, Darren, we made a move that Peyto has never made before. We've made an offer to acquire another company. While you have never ruled out such an acquisition, you have many times said that we had never found one that offered a better opportunity for return on our capital than drilling on land we had acquired ourselves or farmed in on. What makes this deal different? Where are we at with this potential purchase?
Well, you're right, Jim. This corporate acquisition of Open Range is definitely new for us. I mean, it's not that we haven't looked at acquisitions before. We've looked at lots of potential acquisitions, but before we could never see enough upside for the right price that would generate enough return for our shareholders, or a return that would compete with our organic build-it-yourself approach anyway. But this case is definitely unique. Not only is there a ton of drilling inventory, just like the inventory that we have on our own lands, but really the synergies between the two asset bases make it possible to deliver those competitive returns to shareholders. You know, really, Open Range is right in our backyard, and the whole company is really just one big asset right in our backyard. You know, it's not like they have all these different properties spread out all over the place in Alberta, which is usually the case when you are looking at a corporate acquisition. When we look at other corporate acquisitions, we might find one or two properties that might fit within our core area, but then there's a whole bunch that don't. And, you know, we're at Peyto, we're set up to develop opportunities. We're not really set up to divest a bunch of non-core assets. So, you know, where we're at with this transaction, there's a shareholder meeting of Open Range shareholders that's scheduled for next week. That's Tuesday, August 14th. And at that meeting, of course, the shareholders are going to vote to decide if they want to take our proposal of 5.4 million shares now for the 74.7 million shares of Open Range. And if they say yes, then, you know, quickly pending a court approval, we own it. You know, as early as middle of next week, I think Open Range could be a wholly owned subsidiary of Peyto, and we can get busy aggressively developing that asset base too.
Okay. Scott, where does our current production stand? We stated in the latest report that we have been drilling with 6 rigs since the end of breakup season. Has the results of this been seen in our production numbers? Also, our first quarter report, we identified some production was not yet online. How do we stand today compared to the end of the first quarter with those?
Production currently at about 44,000 to 45,000 barrels. We brought on all the wells that were awaiting tie-in at the end of the second quarter, with the exception of one very strong well that we've left standing for strategic reasons. It's in an area of future prospectivity and promise for us, and we'll probably leave it parked for most of this year until some other events happen. We've just recently caught up from the backlog of breakup and following breakup, the periods of wet weather delays that kind of hampered our drilling or our completion activity through June and July. And that catch-up has brought us to this 45,000 barrel level. Closing the Open Range deal in the coming couple weeks would add another 5,000 to 5,400 barrels. So that'll put us over the 50,000 mark to 50 to 51. And as I mentioned, we've got 50 wells to drill over the balance of the year, a very busy second half, which takes us to our exit target of 57,000 for the end of the year. So we're excited. We're seeing the first steps in what will be a very dramatic continued production growth for the company.
Okay. Now turning to Kathy Turgeon, our CFO and VP of Finance. Kathy, two items on our balance sheet seem larger than normal, our prepaid expenses and our prepaid capital. Why have these increased so much? What have we prepaid?
Well, Jim, prepaid capital consists of items such as casing inventory that we buy in advance to secure pricing and availability, and then we move into use over time. And obviously, depending on the purchases, which happen periodically, that balance can move up and down as we transfer those purchases into the ordinary capital to be depleted. Prepaid expenses are typically items such as property taxes that are paid on an annual basis but recognized monthly for accounting. In addition, this year, we've also included the progress payments and deposits that we're paying on the deep cut facility, which is approximately $7 million at the end of June. We will recognize those items in capital when the manufacturing is complete and ownership transfers to Peyto, which we expect to occur in the Q3 of this year.
Okay. Now, Darren, in the first quarter results conference call, I asked you how much Peyto depended on the future price of gas. We can see that we actually had positive earnings in the second quarter with prices at a significant low. While prices have recovered from then, how do you feel about our dependence on natural gas and liquid prices going forward?
Well, Jim, obviously we depend on both gas prices and liquid prices for our revenue, and we can only do so much to lower our costs, you know. But I think we've demonstrated over the last few quarters that we can get along very well with prices that are very low. You know, in fact, prices that probably cause permanent damage to the rest of our industry. You know, as you point out, this last quarter we had $85 oil, $1.75 gas, and we still generated over a 20% profit margin. And, you know, I don't think there's very many businesses that can say that. And yes, right now the future is pointing to more like $90 oil and $3 gas. So we know that with those prices, we're going to generate even more earnings and an even higher profit margin. And I think those prices are still far below the real supply cost average for the Canadian industry and maybe even the U.S. industry as well. You know, we know it, and, you know, I think every investor of Peyto knows it too. And And that is that the best way to insulate yourself from these low-cost spikes and the volatility in the price is to be the lowest-cost producer. That's the big advantage. But, you know, sometimes you have to go through these lows in the commodity prices in order to really drive that point home and really to experience it so that you understand how it works. You know, Warren Buffett always had that saying that it's only when the tide is out that you find out who's swimming naked. You know, that's when we get these really low commodity price environments, that's when the tide is out, and that's when we see who's got the high costs and who can't survive, and, you know, basically who's been swimming naked. And thankfully, at Peyto, we're all fully clothed. Yeah.
Okay. Jessica, at this point, I'd like to turn the call over to questions from investors and representatives of the investment businesses.
First question is from Robert Belinsky from Morningstar. Please go ahead.
Hi, good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I was just wondering, as you look to develop your newly acquired acreage, are you considering anything different from open range in your approach to site selection and well design, or is this just giving you additional runway for growth?
I guess I wouldn't really comment on what open range had in mind. We certainly have our ideas right from the get-go, because the acreage that we're acquiring is very similar to that which we already have, and we've developed a pretty strong expertise in how we develop the types of reservoirs that we're pursuing. So we'll be imprinting our own development plans on those lands, knowing what open range has done a very good job getting things started there, but there's a lot left to be done there, and I think some of our cost advantages will really help with that. We're excited, and it's very similar to what we already have. So I don't think there'd be any new hurdles or challenges to anything that we're not already looking at ourselves.
Robert, I'd add that their development that has occurred on their land base so far, not that dissimilar from the way we, with vertical wells, had developed a lot of our resource base over time in that Sundance area. And now with the horizontal wells, we get to take advantage of a lot of those vertical surfaces. You know, we extend out the existing surface leases, and we lay down three or four horizontal wells from the same pad site, and then all of a sudden there's an efficiency in operation, because you're only driving to one location to check four or five wells that might, you know, represent 15 million a day or more. So, you know, I don't think they really got a chance to take advantage of some of those efficiencies that we've now been enjoying for the last 2 or 3 years. You know, we're into, you know, we've drilled something like 150 horizontal wells. Do you remember their count in terms of horizontals?
I don't.
It was maybe a handful or so of wells. So, you know, I think we're quite a bit more advanced in terms of how we're developing the field and how we're laying the wells out and how we're exploiting the resource that's there. And so, you know, obviously we're going to move right to their lands, right to our state of understanding as to how to develop it.
Just to actually to expand, you tweaked on something that very important. The fact that they've got a number of well sites existing, they've also, through the last couple quarters, installed pipeline and facilities to really set this thing up nicely for future development. There's a couple plants there that have a fair bit of capacity, 20 to 30 million of capacity, ready to be filled up just through the drilling of those lands. So there are several cost advantages already.
Okay, so can you guys disclose just kind of what the average spacing is for the newly acquired lands?
That's a little more difficult to answer, just because they had done some commingling in their vertical wells, and it when you do the commingling of zones, it gets a little more difficult to know exactly how much drainage you're achieving per zone in any one well, because you've got to try and allocate that production down to more than one zone, right? So I would say, you know, as a general comment, the spacing is really at its infancy. You know, if they're getting more than the 100 acres of drainage per zone in any section, I'd be surprised. So it's, you know, I think where we might be, you might argue with some of the zones like the Cardium for us, or even the Nauticuan, we might be in third or fourth or fifth inning of the game. In terms of the development stage, they're definitely still in the first inning.
Okay, and then last one for me. If capital efficiency levels are maintained, how many rigs do you think you guys could ramp up to with this new acquisition?
Well, we're planning to address the rest of the year with 8 rigs, and we're in the early stages of planning for next year, and we have yet to determine what level of rig activity we'd have. But as Darren stated, the workload aspect of 6-8 rigs is certainly manageable. We've just got to get ourselves further organized on how we're going to address next year. But I don't see that we would ever decrease the number of rigs from the 6 to 6-7-8 level that we're going to be going forward with.
The one thing, Robert, is that you were getting a lot more out of every rig these days because the guys are drilling so much faster. You know, I recall back at when I first started with Peyto in 2001, for instance, we would drill a 2,200 meter vertical Cardium well, and it would take us probably 20 to 25 days of drilling to drill that kind of well. You know, now we're drilling a 3,500 meter horizontal Cardium well, for instance, in, you know, sort of 15 days. And so you're getting so much more out of each and every rig that, you know, you really need almost less rigs to drill more wells. It just, we continue to get faster and faster and faster. And I don't think that's just us. I think other plays have seen that. You know, we've heard statistics coming out of places like the Eagle Ford, for instance, where when they first started, the horizontal wells took them 20 days, and now they're down to less than 10 days to drill a well. And so the rig count that you really need to get the job done does, I think, drop off with time as you get into these bigger programs and as you get more efficient in the repeatability of these types of wells.
Okay, that's all I got. Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Thank you. Once again, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad if you have a question. The next question is from Kevin Kaiser from Hedge Eye Risk Management. Please go ahead.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning, Kevin.
On the gas realization for the quarter, pre-hedged, was that a little bit weaker than you guys had expected? And you just kind of comment on that realization.
A little bit. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing, so Kevin, you're referring, I think, probably to the $1.74 per gigajoule of average pricing through the quarter, and what we realized from that of, it was $1.98 or something. That's only about a 14% lift. Normally, we're sort of in that 16 to 17% lift. There's a couple of things playing at play there. As Scott mentioned earlier in the call, we've been fooling around with the temperatures of our reef-rich plants, trying to optimize those to strip as much liquids as we can out. Obviously, the liquids being worth far more than the gas is worth. And so when we do that, when we pull the butanes and the propanes out of the richer gas stream, obviously we lean up the BTUs, and so the realized price we get on the gas side is a little bit less. You know, that's going to be one of the effects even of the deep cut, is we are going to lose some heat content lift, if you will, because we're going to pull those molecules out into liquid form because they're worth a whole lot more in liquid form. And we've already started to do a bit of that. Even though we don't have the deep cut in, we were effectively trying to simulate with some chokes and some extra compression capacity that we had a similar type of a process. Not as large, obviously, but and so that's how we went from, you know, minus 35 to minus 45 temperature range in our reef-rich plants. And as an effect, obviously, we see a bit of a leaning up of the sales gas stream. But, you know, it's all about maximizing the revenue per molecule. And I think we've got designed a system with this deep cut that really does that. And it really, you know, recognizes the fact that certain molecules are worth more as a gas form than liquid form. Ethane, for instance, you know, we're not designing to try and pull ethane into liquid form because it really isn't worth it. So we're trying to be a little bit cognizant, obviously, of where the prices are at for these different products.
Okay, great, thanks. And then on the liquids content, currently around 11%, and I think you said 13 to 14% by the end of year end. When Nose Hill comes on next year, where will that number move to? Is it closer to 15-16%?
Yeah, that would be the expectation. The impact of Nose Hill would also be to add a little over 10 barrel per million for that segment of our production. So another few percent on a corporate basis would be reasonable expectation.
Okay. Those are the first two big plants. Obviously, we, you know, this deep cut concept, we're starting with the largest plant, Old Man. It's about 125 million a day in size. The Nose Hill plant's about 110. And then we get into smaller plants. Our Wild Hay plant's only about 60 million of capacity. The larger Open Range plant's about 60 million. Our Kakwa plant's about 35. So it starts to get obviously less impactful on the deep cut. But we'll keep working our way down the list. And, you know, as long as the first projects continue to operate and realize the pricing that we and the liquids that we think we can get from them, then, you know, we're going to eventually keep moving down our list to convert as many of our plants to the most flexible situation in terms of converting gas into the liquid form if it's worth more.
Right. And then on the southern expansion area, you mentioned in the press release that you expect to see a, you know, significant reduction in operating costs once a 25-kilometer pipeline comes on. What's the timing of that?
We're pursuing that as we speak. Installation would be probably mid-fall. There's some upfront processes that need to occur to get us in a position to start installing that. So sometime November-ish, we should be on stream November, December with those volumes. Those volumes are currently paying anywhere from 60 cents to maybe just under a dollar an MCF for processing at third-party facilities, and we'd expect to bring that whole stream into the same cost regime that we're currently enjoying with our own close-to-home production in the Sundance area.
First, we got to close the Open Range acquisition, though. So, you know, we don't want to get cart ahead of the horse here. Yeah. But, you know, there's obviously some surveying and application and paperwork that we can take care of that doesn't cost us anything to get in a position to be able to do that pending
right.
the close.
Right. And then my last question relates to the Open Range acquisition. You know, I thought the bid from the third party is a bit curious, you know, a 2 or 3% raise to your bid. Just kind of, if you had any thoughts on that, is that sort of, you know, like a jab in your side, or is someone actually interested in taking that asset away from you?
Well, I think any, obviously, bid that's deemed to be a serious bid is a thought by the other party to try and take the asset away. But, you know, I think you can infer from the level of increase that we had to look at, you know, obviously Peyto's bid is still the most logical and the superior bid, and we didn't have to really adjust our bid very much, obviously, to maintain that superiority. You know, I think it's hard for others to come in and compete for the same asset, really, because it fits just so well with Peyto's asset. There's just so many synergies that others can't enjoy. That we're going to enjoy just naturally being right next door to them and being able to quickly connect all of our gathering system into their gathering system and all of our plant infrastructure into theirs. And, you know, we've looked at their land base in association with our own over the last several years. And so, you know, there's no learning curve that has to happen with respect to the asset. We jump on it immediately and start converting those undeveloped opportunities into developed cash flow generating assets for our shareholders and for the joint shareholder, for that matter, even the new Open Range shareholder, if that's the case. So it's just very difficult, I think, for anybody else to come in to realize those same synergies and to somehow extract more value out of Open Range than we can extract from it for shareholders.
Right, makes sense. All right, that's all I had. Thanks, and good quarter.
You bet, thanks.
Thank you. The next question is from Faye Lee from Baldwin Brown. Please go ahead.
Hi, it's Faye Lee. Darren, you mentioned Warren Buffett. I was just curious in terms of, he's generally reluctant to issue shares to buy assets, and I'm curious about your financing decision on the Open Range and how you, your thought process behind that and the decision to issue shares.
Hi, Faye, and thanks for the question. Yeah, you know, I'm a big Peyto shareholder, obviously, and I'm always reluctant to issue shares because, you know, I'm greedy as any other shareholder, and I want to have the most in my per share count. You know, I think in this situation, it's sort of a blend of how we're funding the acquisition, so to speak. About half of it is through equity, and then we assume about $70 million of debt, and there's about $10 million transaction costs that'll be cash too. So, you know, about $80 million of it is cash. So it's a bit of a balance actually between equity and cash. And I guess one of the biggest considerations though was the level of activity of our own asset base. You know, for this truly to be incremental and accretive for all shareholders, it can't disrupt or displace any of the existing capital program that we have going. You know, in my mind, and that was one of the key criteria, was that we had to keep our existing development moving at the same pace that we could have otherwise moved it at with our capital program. And so, you know, that was one of the big considerations for where does the funding come from to pay for this asset. And so we felt that, you know, sort of that 50-50 balance between equity and debt was the best solution. And obviously we truly believe in our heart of hearts that we're going to get more out of this asset base than we have to give up in intrinsic value in paydown. Not that dissimilar to when Warren Buffett issued equity to pay for his Burlington Northern acquisition of that railroad. You know, he sort of commented the same thing, that they had to issue equity to buy it, but they felt that even though that was painful, they were going to get way more out of it in the long term than the cost of that equity. And I think we feel the same about Open Range, that we really believe that there's a ton of opportunity there for shareholders to reap the rewards of over the next few years. And that's quite rare, to be honest. You know, most other little acquisitions, if we don't think that we can get that much upside potential out of them, you know, then we really do justify them on the cash basis and on the competition for capital basis. And this one too, we definitely believe the returns are there in the near term that can compete for the capital, but the long term, more intrinsic value creation for the shareholder, I think, is also there. And that's where, you know, I get comfortable issuing equity against my ownership in Peyto to bring this asset into the fold.
Okay, great. No, that's very helpful. Thanks a lot.
You bet. Great question.
Thank you. We have no further questions registered at this time.
All right. Well, that's great. I realize this is a very busy week, and so people are probably having to listen to lots of other conference calls too. So I appreciate shareholders listening in, especially when it's summertime. But, you know, it's obviously been a very interesting quarter for us with respect to the Open Range acquisition, with respect to, you know, getting through breakup and starting to ramp up our activity levels. And Q3 is going to be crazy around here. Obviously, we're going to have a ton of activity, and we're going to be building production volumes very aggressively, and we expect very efficiently over the next quarter. And so when you're listening in to our third quarter conference call, there should be lots of activity to talk about. So we'll talk to you then.